Good morning. I call the Senate Judiciary Committee to order. Today's Tuesday, March 8th, 2005. It's now about 8:38 a.m. Present Senator Guest, Senator Huggins, myself, Senator Seekins, and Senator French. We have two things on our agenda this morning. We're going to first speak with Skip Cook on his interview for his reapplication for the Select Committee on Legislative Ethics. And Skip, I assume that you're on the line with us this morning. Can you hear me?
Yes, I'm here.
Skip, if you would put yourself on the record just so that we can have that squared away, then we would like to just basically get a summary from you of why you want to be reappointed to this committee.
All right. I'm Skip Cook. I'm related to Dennis E. Cook. I'm from Fairbanks. I'm sort of phasing out of the practice of law, at least on a partial basis. I've been on the committee since, I think, May 8th. I was asked to serve again. There have been some turnover in the committee, and they felt that my experience was valuable, and so I agreed to serve again. I've enjoyed my service on the committee. It's been interesting, complex. There have been good people to serve with, and it's been a challenge that I've enjoyed. So I'm willing to serve again if is your approval.
Okay, just for the record, I've known Mr. Cook for a long time. I know all the Cook family, and everybody knows the Cook family's in Fairbanks, and know many of his wife, his children, you know, so a long-time acquaintance of mine, and actually is probably for 30 years or more I've known him, so just for the record. Skip, just to give you an idea, or give us an idea, when you talk about the work or the complex work of the committee, could you briefly, in your opinion, tell us what you think the major challenges are to being on the committee?
Well, for one thing, the statute under which we deal is fairly complex in its wording and in its concept and its procedures. So we certainly have to keep going back to the statute and trying to fathom the meaning of the statutory language. This isn't necessarily to be critical of the legislature in drafting it, but it is very complex, and being careful with all the procedures that the legislature set out for us to follow can at times be complex. And then the questions that we get seems like a lot of them are right on the edge of whether they fall into unethical conduct or don't fall into unethical conduct. Or we find that it isn't real clear under the statute, you know, whether it does or not. So there's certainly room for various opinions under the statute and under the fact situations that we get. Each case seems to have a different fact pattern that has to be dealt with, and then the legislation applied to that particular fact pattern.
As you have some experience being able to try to interpret statutes in your career, I'm sure, as you look at the statutes that that exist on the Legislative Committee on Ethics, in your opinion, could they be simplified? Could there be improvements there that would be of great assistance to the committee as they contemplate the matters that are brought before them?
They could be, and we from time to time suggest changes. I don't know if we've gone through much rewrite this thing. I don't think that's necessarily the business of the committee, but it certainly is the business when we find things that we can't understand to suggest changes. And we've done that on a number of occasions since I've been on the committee, just to try to make it a little clearer.
Earlier this year, this committee asked the executive director of the Select Committee on Ethics to give us some suggestions on how to simplify several sections of the bill. Has the committee or any of them, have you been aware of whether or not anyone has been, anybody communicate with you on any of that?
Yes, Joyce has a memo pending, and I believe those matters are on the agenda for our next committee meeting. So we've been advised by memo from her, and are considering
Let me ask if other members of the committee at this point would like to ask some questions.
Just one.
Senator French.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Cook, I'm sorry, my packet neglects to tell me how long you've served on the committee.
Well, I think it's since 98 or 99, somewhere in there.
And you would be seeking reappointment to a 3-year term, is that right?
Well, that's one of the changes that has been recommended. We used to have 3-year terms, then it got changed to 2, and that caused some problems with the internal workings of the committee. So I think there's a recommendation that we go back to 3, but I believe there's only 2 at the present.
So if you were reauthorized for this year in 05, you would continue to serve until 07?
That's correct, I believe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That's all.
Thank you. Senator Huggins?
Skip, Senator Huggins here. The question of how a person learns of an opening on the select committee. Could you talk me through that process, how you became a member of the committee?
Well, I became a member of the committee when Chief Justice Skip Matthews at that point called and asked if I would serve. I had not. It's not a position I don't think anybody in the committee has ever gone out and sought. It's been that, I believe that's pretty much the method for everybody, is that you suddenly get a call asking whether you'd be willing to serve on this committee, and I said yes. And that's really all I know about the process. I'm not sure who, well, I guess I vaguely knew the Chief Justice at that time, or, you know, we knew each other casually, but that's all I know, is you felt that I'd be a good person to serve, and he called and asked.
Right. What are the minimum qualifications for an individual to be on the select committee?
I don't know that it's actually set out anywhere. They certainly need to be a citizen of the state, and I guess they need to have somehow caught the eye of the Chief Justice. We've had various people from various professions and walks of life on the committee. I don't think there's any professional requirement of any kind that I know of. So it's a matter of being a resident of the state and somebody through the Chief Justice. Things would be worthy of service. Now, I don't know what he does as far as background check before he comes to that point. That would have to be a question for the Chief Justice.
Right. So in your experience on the select committee, you're a lawyer. Are you in the minority of being a lawyer, or how would you characterize that in comparison to your colleagues?
I have to take account of the committee. I think we have 3 lawyers on there, I think 3 now, myself and Herman Walker and Connor Thomas, unless I'm forgetting somebody.
I think that's right, Skip.
I think that's right. So we're not the majority. I don't know how it would have to be 3 lawyers as opposed to others. We're not the majority, but there are 3 of us.
Right, Skip, in respect to looking to the future, making the assumption that you will continue as a board member, could you characterize what you see as the top 3 priorities that you see from your perspective going forward?
Well, that's a tough question. Let me just give a moment's thought to that. I guess probably our top priority has been and should still be making the people that are subject to the legislative ethics rules aware of what the rules are. In other words, our training function. And we do that by direct training to legislators and legislative employees each session, and we do it through the advisory opinions. And so I think number one is to make sure that that the training remains good in order that we don't have complaints and we don't have violations. If I were a new legislator, you know, I might walk right into a violation without having any clue that I was walking into it unless I had good training, because there's a lot to think about both in the statute and in the previous opinions that have been issued. And we've always had our administrator do a thorough job of training as possible prior to the session. And I think that is really a number one priority in order that we don't have inadvertent violations or any other kind of violations. So training would be number one. I guess number two, would be that we treat the complaints that we get in a manner that is consistent with the statute and gives everybody the due process that's required. And I would include in that the confidentiality that's required. So our treatment of complaints is probably the number two. And then I guess number three would be to improve the act insofar as we can make suggestions that would make the operation go more smoothly.
Okay. Any more, Terry?
Mr. Cook, one other question. In reference to the business of ethics and, in a bigger sense, the confidence in legislators and in the committee, could you tell us any thoughts you have that would be, that proactively we could take that would bolster this confidence over time?
Well, that's the struggle. I believe that, you know, the one that we get, we've struggled with a lot has been the open meetings aspect of things. And ALAC is a bit unique in that regard, in that our legislature meets in a place that is not that simple to get to. And the average man on the street cannot simply get in his car and drive to legislature and make his position known by attending a committee meeting or an open session or whatever, or even to follow the legislation through. So already the legislature, in a sense, is open to public suspicion, if that's a strong word, I don't mean it in totally negative sense, but because you're a bit out of reach. So I think then it's all the more important that for the legislature to operate in a fashion that that is maybe all the more open because of the geographics of the situation. I think the committee has recognized that the legislature has to accomplish legislative business, and there are times when it's difficult to operate as openly as anybody might want, and we also recognize the strategic aspects of being a legislature and the caucuses that are necessary. So we've struggled with that whole aspect. And I just think that the legislature needs to keep that in mind and keep trying to reach with whatever the appropriate balance is in terms of being accessible. What I that I tend to observe in this process is that the ones that are able to follow legislation in this state and have influence on it are those entities that can afford to have full-time lobbyists, because it takes a full-time lobbyist to be there to know what's happening and what's going to happen. And unfortunately, you know, that kind of cuts the man on the street out. And so that, I think, is a dilemma for both the legislature and the public as to how to make it work so that there isn't constant suspicion or constant unrest about what the legislature is doing and why can't I be there. Now, certainly the legislative information offices help to some degree, but it might be in there. So I know that's not suggesting an answer. I'm just saying that, you know, that's a real dilemma for you folks and for us on the ethics committee too.
Skip, Senator Huggins again. Let me offer up one disclaimer. You are not chairman of the Relocate Capital Committee. Is that correct?
I am not.
Okay.
Oh, well, at one time my father was on the committee that chose a new site.
Okay. I say that tongue in cheek. Skip, let's take a little bit of a twist on the question and just ask in respect that, you know, how in this case we bolster the confidence between, if that needs to be bolstered, between the legislature and the legislative ethics select committee.
Well, I don't think we really have a problem between the committee and the legislature. We recognize on the committee that we are a feature of the legislature. They are only to do the job that the legislature tells us. So they set out steps for us to do, and we try to follow that very, very carefully. So we're all part of the same organization. In a sense, the legislature created us to sort of be a monitor of ethics. And we don't view our job as to, go out and be critical. Our job is to help. First of all, the training, help people know what the statute says, how to avoid trouble with it, and then if there are complaints, to handle those in the manner that the legislature set out for us to do. So I don't see a conflict. And of course, the committee is legislators and public members both too. So there's input from both sides as we go along.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Cook.
Other members? Thank you, Skip.
Thank you.
One question I have, a couple that were there. We talk about you may not be aware, but we are working, a number of members of this committee are working on how we can improve the simplicity and the clearness of both this the Legislative Ethics Act and the Administrative Ethics Act to make sure that we don't have undefined terms or that someone doesn't step into a bear trap that they didn't know was there. And I appreciate that, and I see even in the notes of the committee that the executive committee, the executive director, has conducted some training sessions, and that there is printed material that comes to us on a regular basis. And I also believe that you have a great responsibility in terms of confidentiality, and we're trying to look at that as well. As you know, can someone, because ethics can be, an ethics charge can be a black mark even if you're totally innocent for a person, we're looking at how we can properly insulate people from ethics charges as just a political tool through confidentiality, and I will look forward to maybe being able to talk about that a little bit more with you as we go along. But would you think it would be appropriate then for a member of the Select Committee on Ethics to make a public statement that would public comment that would be viewed by the general public as derogatory to the members of the legislature in general?
I
I'm not saying you ever have.
No.
I don't know that you ever have done that. I'm just a general question. So if a reporter came up to you and shoved a microphone in your face and said, "Hey, Skip, you know that Ralph Seekins, he's really mad at you and you might not survive this next hearing on being forwarded on the Select Committee of Ethics because your son sells Chevrolets and he sells Fords," or whatever reason, would it be appropriate for you to comment on that? And by the way, for the record, Skip's son is the General Motors dealer in Fairbanks. And
but not Chevrolet.
Well, I know that. Pontiac, maybe, GMC. What's the difference? You know, what can you say? So, and in that regard, you know, it is a little tough for me to anybody that's related to a General Motors dealer to approve him on an ethics committee, but what can I say?
Are you soliciting a motion, Mr.?
No, not yet. But Skip, one of the questions that Senator Huggins brought up with three members, I was going through the membership also on the public member side. I need to get on the record though, what political affiliation you are, because we do have to reach a balance there, as you know, under the statute.
I'm not registered to either party. I'm a non-registered.
So you're a non-party.
Non-party.
Okay, thank you. I needed to get that on the record. Then, in that regard, when we look at this committee, do you think there would be some benefit to be able to have this committee, the membership of it, reflect a little broader cross-section of the general public, or should we? Right now we have three lawyers and two teachers. Do you think there would be any benefit to representing a little broader cross-section of the public?
Well, to be candid, I always cringe a little bit when the lawyer's appointed because I know that the question is going to come up. But we've had really good people on the committee, and we aren't necessarily in agreement on things either. It certainly leads, you know, it leads to a good thorough discussion of things. And we're from very different aspects of the legal community too. So it certainly would not upset me to have less lawyers, and I don't think we should have more lawyers. I would hate to lose, you know, the colleagues that are on the committee. And as for the teachers, they're very new on the committee. They're wonderful people. They work very hard at understanding and analyzing the issues. I think I agree ideally that if we had a broader base, it would be fine, and that's not meant to be critical of people on the committee. But I certainly wouldn't mind someone encouraging the people that are making the nominations to the committee to over time broaden out some more.
Yeah.
And in that regard, who asked you to serve again?
Well, the first time it was Chief Justice Matthews.
Okay, and this time, and this time around, was it a members of the committee?
Well, I think that the Chief Justice may have spoken to the administrator, you know, just to find out, you know, who was up and so on. And I've been encouraged by other members of the committee and the administrator to consider serving again because they thought the experience would be valuable. So I suspect that got passed on to the Chief Justice.
Okay.
I don't know this Chief Justice personally at all.
Senator Huggins.
Skip, Senator Huggins here again. I'm from the metropolis of Wasilla.
Right.
And, you know, when we talked about the selection of people and nominees in the past, I characterize lightheartedly but in a serious vein, how does my potato farmer from Palmer get on this committee? And I ask you, How would my potato farmer know about this committee?
That's a very good question, and I know there's been some discussion about you know, even advertising, you know, there are openings and people should apply. That's not been done in the past, so I don't know that the potato farmer or even the Fair Mix lawyer would have known about the committee without direct contact. Well, they might know about it from reading about the paper, or, you know, there are times for publicity and so on, but it has not been specifically, any publicity aimed at people stating their availability or interest in serving, and that might be a good thing to do.
Yeah. In that vein, do you think it would be wise of us to at least look at the practicality of widening the scope of how we recruit candidates, or at least make people aware? Because, I mean, I firmly believe that the average person out there would like to believe if they raise their hand, they would at least, number one, they would know about it, so that they could raise their hand based on knowing about the vacancy, but number two, that they would have at least a reasonable opportunity to present themselves as a candidate. And my concern at this point in time is, number one, they do not know about the committee and the openings, and number two, by virtue of that, can't raise their hand. So their ability to do that, if they don't know somebody on the committee or the Chief Justice or somebody in a very close circle of people, then the likelihood of them becoming a committee member is zero.
No, I totally agree with that. I think people should know it. It's kind of like, you know, when there are vacancies for most positions in the state, there's some kind of a notice that goes out, and it would not hurt. It might really enhance the process here to make the vacancies known, and something about what the committee does known. So some kind of a notice would be very appropriate.
Thank you very much, Skip.
And Skip, this is Ralph. I talked with both the current Chief Justice and the immediate past Chief Justice, and in that regard, and said, "How do you determine who you want to put forward on this?" And it is a matter of familiarity. I don't think it's a matter of design. I think it ends up as a matter of familiarity, and that the Chief Justice's world generally revolves in legal circles, and they think of, "Well, who do I know?" And I know Skip Cook, and he'd probably be really good on there, so I'll put his name forward. And even Ms. Rabinowitz is closely associated to the legal profession, even though she's a teacher. So it's kind of been a natural progression, because I don't think there has been an application process or an advertising process. It's been by reference. Someone says, "Well, I know this person or I know that person, so I think maybe I could." And they've looked for some geographical representation in that process as well. So I think there's not been any design. We're just taking a look and seeing if maybe this committee should have a little broader cross section of the general public in its makeup. As we,
I think what you described is exactly what happens. The other factor that may have a play in it too is that the Chief Justice may look at it as somewhat of a judicial thing, and so therefore they feel like they have to have something with legal training, and I don't think that's true at all. And I don't think it hurts to have the training, and it probably helps to have, you know, at least one lawyer on in some ways, but it certainly could be broadened out without it, which is the process.
And the legislature provides a staff lawyer to advise the committee as well. Is that not correct?
That's correct.
Okay. Just to go on just a little bit then, I think we take some of your suggestions, and we're hoping that Joyce will get her suggestions to us very, very quickly. How many times a year does the committee normally meet?
In June, because Joyce has been there for training, we come down and generally have a first meeting of the year down there. That doesn't always happen, and right now the committee has been fully constituted. We haven't had I guess we were down there earlier, but then it depends from there on the amount of business that's before the committee, which generally means complaints. So once a complaint is filed, then we need to meet. We can, for confidentiality reasons, the statute, you know, and the procedures require us to meet face-to-face on complaints that are required to be confidential. So, and they can require a quick flurry of meetings, or they can require a series of meetings that are not all that quick, depending on the nature of the complaint and how much investigation needs to be done, and so on. So traditionally, the committee hasn't just scheduled meetings unless we have items that are pressing. Sometimes those are complaints. Sometimes we can have a meeting even when there isn't a complaint, if we have things like revision of the statute or so on the agenda. Sometimes we meet telephonically when we don't have to meet face-to-face. There have been cases, even if I was on the committee, back in the days of the Jackal case, where so many needs were required, it really kicked the budget up and exceeds the budget. And so we are kind of careful to make sure that if we get a complaint that requires a number of meetings, that we haven't run our budget funds low by having meetings we didn't absolutely have to have. So I guess my answer is, we meet as often as necessary, generally, at least once early in the year. And then we just either meet telephonically to conduct business or meet face-to-face with the meeting.
And Skip, without revealing any confidentiality to any matter, do you know if there's anything on the calendar of the committee right now that would require a meeting in the near future?
I have been gone for about 3 weeks, and so I haven't had a chance to consult with Joyce on that.
So not to your knowledge?
Not to my knowledge. That doesn't mean it's not there.
Right. I understand that. With that caveat. Any other questions from other members?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator French.
Thank you. Mr. Cook, I've just been named to the committee. Why don't you tell me where the face-to-face meetings happen so I'll know where to go?
Well, we tried meeting one in Juneau once, generally our other meetings are in Anchorage in the legislative building there where our legislative committee office is. On
board, Andrew. Questions from members? Senator Huggins?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I move that the name of Mr. Dennis Skip Cook be forwarded to the Senate floor for a joint session for consideration. This is not to reflect the intent by any member to vote for or against the individual during any further session.
Is there objection? Hearing none, Skip, you've survived another interview. Thank you very much for your time today.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Take about a 5-minute recess. We're back on the record. We next want to turn to Senate Bill 67. Mr. Hove is here to do our original presentation. And Mr. Hove, if you'll put yourself on the record, we're eager to hear your statement this morning.
My name is Brian Hove, staff for Senator Seekins. We're presenting Senate Bill 67 today. This is an act relating to claims for personal injury or wrongful death against health care providers. Senate Bill 67 amends Alaska Statute 09.55 by adding a new section. This section places a $250,000 limit on non-economic damage awards where health care providers render services. This bill intends to alleviate a growing two-pronged crisis in Alaska's health care industry. First is the dearth of liability insurance carriers, and secondly, the declining number of practicing, not just licensed, physicians. Liability insurance is one of life's absolute necessities. As drivers, we are required to have liability coverage before we get behind the wheel. As homeowners, we understand the protection liability insurance provides. Now imagine if Allstate, State Farm, and GEICO found the Alaska market litigiously perilous and decided to pull up stakes. What would rates do? Healthcare providers, too, understand the necessity of liability coverage. The fact is, in today's world, no commercial enterprise dares go bare. But where our state's healthcare industry is concerned, the lack of carriers is not hypothetical. It's a reality. Medical malpractice insurance companies have found Alaska uneconomic and have left the market. This has created much uncertainty and opened the door to higher rates across the board. These added costs of doing business are, of course, paid by every Alaskan needing medical care. But there is a much more serious problem, that being a critical shortage of physicians. Fact is, Alaska ranks near the bottom in the number of physicians per capita. Over half of Alaska's physicians exceed the age of 50. Furthermore, it gets continually more difficult to recruit new entries for other states when other states have capped non-economic damages at or near $250,000. The bottom line, despite all our natural assets, Alaska is viewed as an undesirable place for medical insurance carriers to do business, and as a result, for physicians to set up shop. This is, without question, a complex issue. Yet, other states have effectively placed an upper limit on non-economic damage awards, thereby providing a stable, predictable, insurable climate. Senate Bill 67 follows this national trend. It's important to note that this legislation does not alter awards for quantifiable damages, such as lost wages and medical expenses, and does not affect awards for gross negligence or reckless behavior. Furthermore, it is not intended to be a silver bullet solution to an entire range of issues facing our healthcare industry today. However, it does provide a step in the right direction in terms of stabilizing the medical insurance market here in Alaska and boosting our efforts to attract the next generation of physicians.
Question is for Mr. Hope. Senator French.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Hope, I'm sure we'll hear from lots of the witnesses who may have a broader range of knowledge than you do, so I don't mean to put you on the spot, but I know you've helped the sponsor carry this bill a couple of years now, and so I thought I'd ask you just a couple of questions about the bill itself. One question is, current law differentiates between sort of pain and suffering losses for some injuries that are inflicted through negligence, and then there's a differentiation for severe permanent physical impairment or severe disfigurement that can get you to a higher level. This bill does not do that, am I right? There's no differentiation?
I don't believe there is.
Correct.
And was that just like a strict policy decision just sort of to set that distinction aside, or was it based on some insurance-driven reason?
Well, you know, the whole idea behind this legislation is to make the market more attractive. The marketplace, as it currently stands, is not attractive. What can we do? Like the sponsor statement indicates, it's not a silver bullet solution. However, it is one step, and that's our approach: is to take it one step at a time.
your sponsor statement notes that there's many states have kept their non-economic damages at $250,000. How many states have that size of a cap?
Oh, offhand, I'm going to say probably 20% of the states have a $250,000 cap.
So roughly 10. And last question, this may just be a drafting, something you need to take up with your drafters, but on page 3, lines 11 through 14, looks like that those are the kinds of things that you can still compensate a person for non-economic losses. Pain, suffering, inconvenience, physical impairment, disfigurement, loss of enjoyment of life, loss of consortium, and other non-pecuniary damages. You can still recover for those non-economic losses. Is that the way I read it?
Let's read it together here.
Sure. Damage claims for non-economic losses shall be limited to compensation for pain, suffering, inconvenience, physical impairment, disfigurement, loss of enjoyment of life, loss of consortium, and other non-pecuniary damage, but may not include hedonic damages. So I can recover for pain, right, for suffering, for inconvenience, for physical impairment, for disfigurement. Are you with me? Is that, I'm reading this right? But I can't get more than, under this bill, $250,000, right? So I guess, I can't help pointing out, I can sue for loss of enjoyment of life on lines 11 and 12 and 13, but I can't sue, because down here, but I can't sue for hedonic damages, and that's for the pleasure of being alive. Do you see my point?
Well,
what's the difference between loss of enjoyment of life and the pleasure of being alive? Or is there a difference?
Sounds pretty close to me.
But drafting issue?
It might be. However, I will, as you've already noted, say that there are people here that are much more much better equipped to answer this question specifically than I am, and we'll let them take a shot at that as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Mr. Hova, I think everybody on this committee understands that the reason for a public hearing on a bill is that no product is perfect when it first starts out, and they're all subject to proposals for amendment or for clarification. So with that, we'll move. Senator, guess.
Thank you. I just had two questions on your testimony.
Sure.
And again, I know we're going to have a lot of other people testify. Can you tell me, I didn't see it anywhere in the packet, how you decided on the $250,000, or even to the Senator, but just what the policy decision was?
Currently, it's the limit is 400, and it's a soft limit. Now, the idea here, of course, again, is to provide some relief and encourage some competition in the marketplace, competition which will hopefully provide benefits to all of us. Now, is 250 the magic number? Nobody knows. 250 is the number that a lot of states are using, and that's the number that we have chosen to try here.
I mean, often we look to other states and what they're doing. I was just wondering.
Certainly.
And then just the other question is, you had stated that Alaska has one of the lowest doctor-patient ratios, and somewhere in this testimony it says that there are six other states with lower or that are worse off than Alaska. Do you know what those six other states are, or could you get those for me?
Somebody in this room, I'm sure, knows. I don't have that off the top of my head.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Huggins.
Mr. Trove, if I might, in a moment I'm going to ask you to make sure I got these variables right of what we're talking about here, but essentially I'll put a check back and I'll come back to the medical practitioners, patients, the legal system, and the insurer, or the parties involved here. Is that about right? And money.
ends up being what we're talking about here, because of course about $400,000, $250,000, why you get it, and so it's going back and forth. But we'll get back to that. You know, this is a little bit foreign to me. We're all shaped by our experiences. You know, once upon a time, I get to go around the world, throw hand grenades and shoot machine guns and crawl under them and have people throw hand grenades at you and shoot artillery at you and fire missiles and all those sorts of things, trying to make you a statistic called killed in action or wounded in action. And there was a thing called confidence of those young people that we asked to do that, that they would get fixed up when it was all said and done. But lo and behold, the system in the bottom line, and what makes it so foreign to me, is that the confidence in the system was such that you can't sue. You can't sue those people that take care of you. It's just, there is no right to sue. And it's a, so when we get into this conversation, it sort of makes my head spin because it's foreign language when I see what we're getting at here. Now, let me get back to my question. The medical practitioner sets up, has a shingle setting there. The patient comes to see them, and something happens, and lo and behold, the legal system then goes into play, and then there's a pot of money that the practitioner has contributed to for insurance, and the insurer's holding over on the side, invested someplace, and there's vying for how much money is going to come out of that pot, assuming that somebody's held liable. Is that about right?
Roughly, sure.
Okay. And what you're proposing is the amount of money that comes out of that pot is capped at $250,000 under certain circumstances.
Yeah.
Okay. I just want to make sure, because like I said, it was foreign to me. So I understood what we were talking about and make sure it worked.
Okay. Other questions for Mr. Hove? Thank you, Mr. Hove. Let's, have you got that one list of states? Just, we'll provide this, but basically when we look at other states, California is the one that has been most mentioned over the last year. In the second half of the last session is when this bill came to the committee. That's at 250. Kansas is at 250,000. Montana is at 250,000. Ohio is at 250,000. Texas recently moved to 250,000. West Virginia at 250,000, except in cases involving wrongful death, permanent and substantial physical deformity, or other serious injuries. The national legislation that has been much discussed already, but does that I believe will probably be set out there, is using a target of $250,000 for non-economic damages, and I think that's probably an overall description of the category for non-economic damages. No one is suggesting in any bill that medical care be cut short, or that it not be fully funded, or there be no liability for medical care to take care of a problem that exists. I don't think anyone would even think of suggesting that should be shortcut in any respect whatsoever. Now, I think we're going to, as we go along, I'm sure that this is going to be well represented by all sides of the issue. And as the chairman of this committee, I'm going to attempt to provide appropriate public participation wherever we can. If I see that we're in a position as a committee where we're getting redundant testimony, or where we're trying to get the group of people to testify before the committee stacked to produce an artificial number of for and against, then I'll try to equalize that out so that everybody has a chance to get their opinion. And that we can do so in a very orderly manner. With that in mind, I think Roland Gower is first on my list. Is that how you guys want to proceed at this time, Roland? And Roland, if you would put yourself on the record and tell us your affiliation We're eager to hear your testimony this morning.
Thank you, Senator Seekins and other members of the committee for this opportunity. My name is Roland Gower. I am a general surgeon who practices in Anchorage. I've been in Alaska since 1975, where I came as the military and observed the first malpractice crisis back then from the outside looking in because I was not in private practice. I am a member of the board of directors of Alaska Physicians and Surgeons and a past president. And I've been involved with the Alaska State Medical Association since I went into private practice and have been a delegate for at least 15 out of the 25 years that I've been in practice. I've been chief of surgery at both major hospitals in Anchorage and chief of staff at Alaska Regional. So I'm here today to talk to you about something that I am concerned about, and I thank you for the opportunity to do so. When I mentioned to my nurse last Friday that she needed to reschedule 25 patients today, she looked at me like I was crazy and how she was going to do it. So I assured her that this is an important thing for me to do, and my patients, I'm sure, will understand when I see them tomorrow and explain it to them. But just as importantly, I am thankful for guys like you who are willing to leave your homes for 5 months out of the year and come down here to this beautiful but yet isolated place to address issues like this. And I think this is an issue and a problem facing our state that we are all concerned about. We're looking for a solution. I love my profession. I love what I do, but I also have a vested interest here in that I have a family here, and I think we have a real issue with medical access if this problem is not solved in some way in the near future. It affects me, and it affects you, and it affects your families, and I think it could be very closely tied in with the problem with medical access and Medicare, and also in the workman's comp issues. If we don't have malpractice insurance, we have a true crisis in the state. And so this is not Houston we have a problem, this is Juneau we have a problem, in my opinion. What has happened over the last several years is that short as 3 years ago, we had five or maybe six insurance companies that offered liability insurance to medical practitioners in this state. We currently are down to two. The ones that have left were stock companies that practiced here or sold a product here for profit. The two companies that are left are both physician-run, physician-directed boards, mutual companies, and both are in California, and both have been here for quite some time. They are not for profit. They are to provide a service and medical insurance to those who practice medicine. I have been insured by one of those companies since approximately 1982, and at one time during a fee crisis, but not availability crisis in the mid to late 80s, my premiums went almost to $100,000. We have had very favorable rates over the last 10 years or so until approximately 2000, and they started going up again. And this year, my premium is up 12%, and it has doubled since 2001. It has not made it to the $80,000 range yet, but I have real concern that we are heading in that direction. They're also, one of the companies has limited the type and extent of the policies that they're writing for some practitioners. So even though we still have two companies, the availability to new practitioners coming in the community has been limited. And I think this is specifically with NorCal in the area of OBGYN practice and the limits on the policies of which they're offering. There was a time when this was simply a cost of doing business. My premiums go up to $100,000. The cost is passed on to the patient. But in today's market, it is hard to raise your fees or your income because the great majority of how we are reimbursed is with a preferred provider contract of which you accept payment, and there's no way to charge the patient or balance bill. So this increase in premiums is going to be a difficult pill to swallow if we, for all of us, if this approaches, if the premiums approach to what they are in some of the states. And for instance, in Florida, there are neurosurgeons and cardiac surgeons and OBGYN surgeons that are paying upwards of $200,000 a year for their liability insurance. And certainly the trend in Alaska is that we're heading towards much higher premiums. But more importantly than that is the issue of availability of insurance. If it goes away, I think we will have a crash landing in Alaska and a true crisis, and I'm not sure when that's going to happen, but with from the trend that we're heading, I have great concern that that is what is going to happen. Back when this occurred previously in the early 80s, I was a young man without a family and no particular reason to protect assets because I didn't have many. But the problem with the physician population in Alaska now is that half of us are over 50 and we're towards the end of our career, and there are many that could retire, or maybe not as comfortably as they would like to, but would quit tomorrow if the insurance availability went away. I do not think you will see physicians and surgeons in this in this state practicing bare and exposing what they have worked for and saved all their life and their retirement without insurance. So affordability is one thing, availability is certainly another big issue. I think it's definitely a problem that we face in recruiting new doctors to come to Alaska. My specialty within itself is short-handed in Anchorage. I think it is in Fairbanks, and I know that it is in Juneau. At least eight of us are over 50 years old. Several of us are over, four of us are over 60, and these people are going to stop soon. And if they're not replaced, there's not going to be anybody here to take up the slack. And it is very difficult to try and recruit somebody to come up here and open a practice. I have a daughter that, if things go as planned, will probably start the medical school next year. And I would very much love to see her come to Alaska and practice medicine and raise her family where I'm going to retire, but I couldn't advise her to do that. I would tell her to seek a market to practice in where there's much more stability, where she has a fair degree of certainty that she will be able to get liability insurance. So I think what we have now is reasonable affordability, but it's going up. It's going up rather rapidly. Availability has certainly been limited in the last several years, and we have a very volatile situation. We look at the state that everybody looks to for how they solve their liability problem, and California, I think, is probably one of the most litigious societies on the face of the earth, but 30 years ago, they made a cap on their non-economic damages, and it brought stability to their insurance market. And I think arguably California, even in their litigious society, is one of the stablest insurance markets in the country, and they do not have the problems that we are facing. There are other ways to solve this. I just don't see society as a whole looking at some of the other solutions, like mandatory arbitration or a review board to look at suits, limiting attorney fees, a malocurrence insurance where every patient would buy an insurance and if something went wrong. These are other potential solutions, but I don't see us moving in that direction. And what this bill is about is providing predictability and stability to the insurance companies that practice in this state. And I certainly have limited knowledge about how rates are set and what determines that, but the insurance company that I've been with for almost 23 years now is doctor-owned, not-for-profit, and I am told that the one thing that would make predictability in the state of Alaska would be a defined cap on non-economic damages, nothing to do with true economic damages, cost of medical, future payments, etc., but a cap on Non-economic damages and a definition of what non-economic damages are. Texas has recently passed a referendum by a popular vote, and they have limited their liability on non-economic damages. It was one of the crisis states up until this happened 2 years ago. I think it's too early to say whether it has solved their problems, but it certainly has appeared, at least initially, to make a difference. And there are other there are other markets or other areas of states of practice in the United States where they truly have the crisis, like Florida, New Jersey, that I think Alaska is facing, and we've got the opportunity to head that off. But we're talking about access to medical care here, and it is going to be very difficult to solve this, I think, if the liability market is not stabilized. Thank you.
Thank you. Doctor, some people say that all we need are better doctors and the problem will go away. Could you comment on that?
Well, I would make two comments on that. I am very impressed with the level of medical care that the Alaskan citizens have are privileged to. I think the level of care that's provided in this state is equal to or as good as any state in the United States. There are always doctors that make mistakes. We will always make mistakes. Doctors are human beings. They're not perfect. Whether there's a way to make us better or more perfect, there probably are some practitioners that are on the edge, and that's another issue of licensure and what to do about those and the difficulty and getting rid of those that are on the edge that do not practice good medicine. But no matter how good a doctor you have, there are going to always be issues and things that don't go right because this is not a perfect science. So it's not a perfect science.
Okay, thank you. Questions from Senator Huggins.
Thank you, Dr. Guerra. Following some accounts of malpractice sorts of things in the media, one of the comments I've heard over time is that doctors don't police themselves. And you mentioned you're a member of an association. Could you characterize for us if there is a policing mechanism for people that, let's call them, excuse the term, bad actors as physicians, or is there a system for that?
Well, yeah, there's just a multi-tiered system in this state of how people are credentialed and policed. First of all, getting a medical license. There's a state medical board that everybody, in order to practice in the state, has to get a license, and you have to go before that board. I think one of the issues in that area is that it's very, very important that before you ever let them in the door, that you are absolutely certain that they are qualified, that they're trained. You can't always know everything about that, but because once they're in, it is much more difficult to take somebody's license away. There are many issues involved in that. I personally, back in the mid-80s, was involved in a issue of taking away the surgical privileges of a doctor that went all the way to the Supreme Court. And that was a real issue because he charged the hospital committee that limited his credentials, since some of us were surgeons in his same field, with antitrust issues. And if we lost, then the damages, I think, are treble or quadrupled or whatever. So there is a growing problem over the last several years because of the courts, of doctors willing to police themselves. And that is an issue, but we still do it. We still do it at the hospital level. Everybody who practices in a hospital has to pass a credentialing process that is very, very rigorous to the point that sometimes it takes months and months and months before that person is given hospital credentials. So, and then beyond that, within the specialty societies, like the Alaska Physicians and Surgeons, we have a credentialing process of where they're looked at before they can be a member of our organization, etc. So there are many levels at which doctors are examined. There's ongoing requirement in continuing education. There's ongoing re-licensure at the state level. There's ongoing re-credentialing every 2 years at anybody that has hospital privileges. But it is difficult to remove a marginal practitioner in some instances, because unless it's just, you know, gross negligence and obvious problems, because of the other side of the legal issues of how we're set up to, and rightly so, to protect a person's livelihood and not let personality issues, etc., get involved in whether somebody is licensed or not, or whether somebody has privileges in the hospital. But that's a long, convoluted answer, but we are, as physicians, looked at every, you know, frequently re-credentialed and whatever, and when a problem is observed, efforts are made to remove that person from the practicing pool, but it's not always easy.
Let me make sure I get this right. I only know what I read in the newspaper, and you know how that is. But as I recall, that the oversight is by the state medical board. That's the ultimate authority. Is that accurate?
You need a state license to practice, but you can have a license and not get credentialed in a hospital. So a surgeon can get a license from the state, but if the credentials committee in that hospital thought that that person was not capable of doing a total hip, even though he's got a license to practice, he doesn't have privileges in that hospital. So that's a second tier of how people are looking.
Right. Yeah. So two-tier protective system. Now, in respect to your practice and your liability insurance, the rise in your rates, is that based on how effective you are as a doctor, or is it influenced by a colleague down the street that, for one reason or another, there was a high settlement?
Our insurance is like any insurance. It's pooled risk, and they don't, to my knowledge, they don't rate an individual on his past malpractice experience. In other words, there might be somebody who has had two or three suits that he has defended, and somebody in the same specialty who has had none, but they don't individually rate a person's policy on the basis of that. What determines the policy rate is how long you have practiced, for one thing, the number of years of statute of limitations that you have, etc., is a risk pool, etc. But it's basically an entire risk pool is what determines the premiums. But within the practice of medicine, there are definitely some specialties that are more risky than others. A doctor that's doing OBGYN, even though I do some fairly risky things as a general surgeon, his liability is much higher, and it's also true for neurosurgeons doing back surgery and things like that. So within the state of Alaska, a practitioner doing nerve surgery versus one doing, let's say, ear, nose, and throat, their premiums may be actually double difference from the same limit of coverage.
Right. And if you could characterize for us, in, let's say that there's been a malpractice accusation, legal proceedings are on the horizon, that it appears to me, only from news accounts, that there's a growing trend, no matter whether it's medical or anything else, to try to out-of-court settle. Is that accurate or inaccurate?
Well, I think that's certainly in medical malpractice, that is always the best thing to do if you can.
Why is that the best thing to do?
Well, to try a medical malpractice case alone, I think probably by the times the fees are added up for both sides, you've put $150,000 onto it. So why spend that money in court if you can come to a solution outside of court? So
where does that $150 on each side, where does that come from?
Well,
who pays?
My understanding from the defense side, medical malpractice insurance covers that if you have insurance. For the most part, on the plaintiff's side, it's a contingency thing. I'm not sure that that's always the arrangement, but most arrangements is that the plaintiff's attorney doesn't get paid unless he wins the case. And so that money then, if he wins the case, also comes out of medical liability insurance, because the doctor's insurance pays the attorney fees on the other side.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Other questions? Senator Guess.
Yes. Actually, the first question is for you, Mr. Chair. I had some questions regarding the letter from the Alaska State Medical Association, and I'm not sure if I should ask them of this witness or if there's someone who is going to speak to. I don't have the list of testifiers in front of me.
Since I don't know what you'll ask, go ahead and ask, and we'll see if we can answer it.
Okay. I guess one of the questions was a question I asked Mr. Hove about. Six states have lower doctor-to-patient ratios. By any chance, do you know which six those are?
I don't.
Okay. I'm sure one person.
But there's someone here does.
I think Mr. Jordan knows that.
Okay. Great. Thank you. I just had two questions. One was a follow-up of Senator Huggins. You had talked about that the process for removing a physician from practicing is difficult, and one can understand why it should be. Can you quickly go through what that process is, and could you comment on whether or not the legislature should look into that process and why it is so difficult, and if it is too difficult in the state?
Well, you know, I don't know that I would characterize it as too difficult. First of all, let me say, I have never served on the state medical licensing board, even though I've been invited. I've never done that, so I don't have any firsthand experience. I have been involved in the credentials committee of both hospitals, and I have been involved in disciplinary actions against doctors on staff. And, you know, there's a fine line between what you can do and what you can say and the motives that are implicated in what you're doing when you're trying to remove somebody off the staff who you think is not practicing good medicine. It's always, almost always, implied that those trying to remove them are in competition with them, because that's who judges them. I mean, I wouldn't want a neurosurgeon judging how I take care of breast cancer. So the person who is judging how somebody practices is somebody else who treats breast cancer and is directly in competition with that person. So there, you know, the bylaws are set up where there are multiple hearings, multiple levels of review, multiple things that happen before you can take somebody's hospital privileges away from them, and that is certainly true at the state level also. It's a difficult thing to do, and in the instance that I was alluding to before, which made me very concerned about trying to do the right thing for the community of Alaska to protect them from who I thought was an incompetent practitioner, came back to personal liability for me, because if it was proven in court that I was trying to limit his ability to practice medicine, thereby antitrust, then the damages were mine personally. And so it gets to the point where you are very careful about how far you stick your neck out, especially, and you know, we're coming close to getting into names and individuals here, but there have been people practicing on the very fringe as far as most mainstream medicine is concerned in the state, and one, that person ended up getting appointed to the state medical board by one of our governors. So there are some issues here. Whether something needs to be done at the state medical board level that makes it easier to remove a practitioner, I think probably not. I think what I have seen in the last year, that there has actually been some heavy-handedness at times with the State Medical Board, and I don't know whether you're aware of some of the stuff that's been going on there. And with Mr. Urien involved in it now, I think the physicians feel a lot more comfortable about that process now. So I don't think the legislature needs to address anything about how we credential people. And I think the process is there. I think it works, but it might be more appropriate to ask that question of people who serve on the board. Within the hospital, I think it works. It's very difficult, and it should be hard to take somebody's away privilege away for how they make their livelihood. But on the other hand, you know, there are instances where patients need protecting.
Thank you.
Any questions for Mr. Gower? Go ahead. Senator Guess.
Thanks, Mr. Seekins. I just wanted to ask you quickly, you said there are other solutions, and I've been actually reading about those other solutions, because we always seem to come down to only one solution, which is this the cap issue. But you had stated, but the public wouldn't want that. And I have to say before, when I knew I was this bill was coming in front of me, I did some research and read about some other solutions. And, you know, I'm fairly well read, but, you know, there were some solutions out there that I had never seen before, and I don't think the public has seen. Can you comment on kind of why you don't think the public would want other solutions from your
experience? I said public, I didn't mean public. I'm not sure. First of all, it's a very, very complex situation and issues. And I think, to be quite honest, there's not a great majority of the public who has a full comprehension of the various ways that this problem could be solved. But there are other ways to solve it, but I don't think it's in the hands of the physicians, and I don't think it's in the hands of the public. I think it's in the hands of partisan legislation and various interest groups pulling and who's right, who's wrong, or whatever. I mean, I personally think, and I think this statistic is accurate, that it makes no sense in a system where 40% of my insurance premiums and my colleagues' insurance premiums that are paid to compensate patients that are injured by the procedures and malocurrences end up in the hands of attorneys. That's not right. Why should 40% of the insurance doctors' pay end up in the plaintiff's attorney's hands and the defense attorney's hands and not the injured patient? Now, you tell me how to fix that. I think that is an accurate statistic, but that's not right. But how to fix it? And make me czar, and I can give you a lot of solutions, but, you know.
Me too. You'll have to get in line for that request.
Well, you know, that's what this process is all about. You hear from me, you guys, you know, get the information and evaluate it, but fix that one if I'm right, and check my statistics. But that, you know, that's not okay. I mean, the money that we're paying to compensate injured patients doesn't go to them because of the expense of the system and how we administrate it and how we settle our issues and difference when patients are injured. And patients are injured, not necessarily intentionally, but this is not a perfect science. I mean, I don't think people realize how hard it is when we go to fix something in the human body. It goes right 99% of the time, but 1% of the time, it's a bad deal and people are injured by it, but not necessarily always by negligence. So
I just wanted to clarify, I think what you meant was 40% of the payouts versus 40% of your premiums.
No, I think it's 40% of the total cost of the premiums.
Of the premiums.
Well, I mean, okay. If you want to take out administrative costs and whatever.
No, I was just making sure that you meant premiums and not payouts, that the insurance premiums, 40% of those.
Exactly.
Okay,
that
so
is,
it was premiums.
Yeah. Of all the money that's paid into a risk pool to defend medical malpractice and compensate patients.
I just wanted to make sure. And then the quick question I had was on, you had mentioned that your rates have doubled since 2001. Can you comment on the percentage of your premiums to your overall costs or your overall revenue. I'm just wondering about what's going on to the other costs. Are they increasing at kind of the same rates or different rates?
In 1988, my overhead of a premium of $100,000 was close to 15-18% of my total revenue.
In with your 1998, and then it went down, and then it went back up.
And down significantly, and now it's going back up. And what has happened in the practice of reimbursement of medicine nationwide is that the reimbursement level is down significantly. And if premiums go back to where they were, I quite honestly don't know how they practice in Florida. I don't know how anybody can afford an overhead of, some people paying almost $300,000 down there.
So it was 15 to 18% in 1998 of your revenue versus, are you seeing other costs go up at kind of the same rates? So the cost percentage is somewhat staying the same, but the revenue percentage is shifting. Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, and I think Florida currently in 2003 has it. $500,000 cap that can be increased to $1 million under certain circumstances at the moment, just for reference. Other questions for the doctor? Seeing none, I just really appreciate your coming in all the way up here to talk to us today. One of the things that I would say, we are looking, some of us on the committee are looking at other ways to be able to address the very issue that you brought up, that being the huge amount of cost in litigating a medical malpractice claim, sometimes taking 2.5-3 years before they're settled. The huge cost of all the different costs of litigation, expert testimony, the discovery practice that goes on back and forth. And there have been suggestions that in order to more properly address speedier resolution, where a larger percentage of the money that's paid out would go directly to the person that's injured, that we consider an arbitration step prior to litigation in the court. Have you or your association given any consideration to that?
Well, it's something that we talk about, but we don't plan for it because we don't think it's going to ever happen, either at the local level or the national level. But, personally, and I'm not talking for my organization right now, I mean, to me it makes sense. First of all, there ought to be a review process before a lawsuit is filed. All it takes is $75, and once that lawsuit is filed, whether there's any reasonable claim at all, that costs money, and it costs time of other attorneys and doctors and whatever. And I mean, you can file a lawsuit without even getting a medical expert to tell you whether you've got a case or not. So I mean, that issue right there alone, that's wrong. I mean, here's a shot in the dark. Let's file it and then see where the chips. You ought to have to do your homework and decide whether there's any case there. Need a reasonable person to review it to tell you whether there's been any liability or whether there's any liability. But yes, I certainly think that arbitration makes sense. If it fails, then it fails. But why not make the effort at trying to solve these things? And, malpractice cases are a lot like divorces. It's great for the attorneys if they can keep the two parties fighting. Whereas if the two parties could come together and all this party wants is their medical expenses that cost them for this malocurrence, that's all they want, but your insurance company can't let you talk with them about that, because once you agree to do that, then they tell you that you have admitted fault by doing that. I actually have personal experience back in the early 80s, because I have a good relationship with my insurance company and know them very well. I had a malocurrence. I mean, it was just wrong what happened. And it was a guy who was in the insurance industry. And it ended up, for me to fix what went wrong, costing him $7,000 or $8,000, plus having to go through an operation that he didn't need before it happened. But I went to him, and he's in insurance. He understands it. I got my insurance company. I told him, I trust this guy. I think we can work it out. All he wants me to do is pay his hospital bill for what happened, you know, what went wrong in the office. And we settled it. Paid his hospital bill. There was never any liability. He didn't sue me for pain and suffering and the scar that he had on his abdomen, whatever. My insurance company was very, very reluctant to let me do that. They generally will not, because where it leads to when it gets into a court of law, that's discoverable, and they say, well, if you offered to pay him, then you must have been guilty, so let's give him the farm. You screwed up. We make mistakes, and a lot of these things could be settled much more reasonably without opposing attorneys fighting each other, watching each side's right, and I do think it would work, but I don't see us going there.
Thank you. Other questions? Thank you very much, sir. Appreciate your being here. I'm going to go next to Mr. Dillo, is it? Is it Dillo or Dillon?
Dillon.
I couldn't tell. Like most professionals, as we get older, our handwriting gets somewhat obscured. Mr. Dillon, welcome to the Senate Judiciary Committee this morning. I see you're back again this year.
I am.
Just before you get started, yesterday afternoon, our office received this white paper from the Alaska Action Trust, and I wanted to make sure that every member of the committee had this. I don't know if it was sent to you as well, but just for the benefit of the committee, I wanted to make sure that you all had a copy of this. Mr. Dillon, welcome back.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You'll put yourself on the record. We're eager to hear your testimony this morning.
Sure. My name is Paul Dillon. I'm an attorney. I've been practicing in the state of Alaska since 1979. I'm with the law firm of Dillon & Finley. We have offices in Juneau and in Anchorage. Our primary points of practice are, or at least mine, are representing insureds against insurance companies. Other members of my firm do malpractice work. And we also represent physicians, both with regard to their insurance companies and in their business practices. I'm here not testifying on behalf of anyone other than myself, and to the extent that I'm the first name on the letterhead of my firm, I'm representing my firm, I guess. And I was here last year. Mr. Chairman, as you'll recall, I was here primarily over issues of insurance. I have a view that the issue before this committee today is really an insurance issue. And I think the good doctor specified that in the context that, and as did the bill's sponsor statement, in that what you're trying to do is create a conducive market for insurers. As I did last year, I went to the Division of Insurance, which is where I usually end up going on insurance questions, and picked up the Division 66 annual report and did some comparisons with regard to the 65th and the 66th annual report insofar as the state of affairs, insofar as insurance in Alaska is concerned. And I'll comment on that. In addition, Division of Insurance produced a report which produces annually on the effects of the medical malpractice legislation. The last report was in October of 2004, and their comments, I don't know if the committee has those comments, but I trust that you do or will. And the balance of my comments will be based upon various journals, including the New England Journal, various press releases, and the like. This bill is premised on the basis that there is a crisis in Alaska. And the circumstances of the crisis, which frankly I appreciated the good doctor's remarks, are not born, as the chairman referred to, bad medical care. The doctors in this state, I don't think I've ever heard, Mr. Chairman, in 30 years or so of practice, somebody suggesting that the doctors in this state are bad and if we had better doctors, it'd go away. In the context of our practice, good people can get bad results. Sometimes those results don't lead to lawsuits, other times they do. But the point of it is that from the perspective of attorneys that are involved in the practice, what we've seen of the medical profession in Alaska is that, as the doctor indicated, that by and large they are very, very good. What we do see in Alaska is that it's a tiny insurance market, plain and simple. You're not a player. You've got NorCal and you've got MICA here. They're the big gorillas on the block. They control 80% of the insurance market. Everybody else is small time, you know, maybe 9% or less in terms of writing and issuing in this state. The fact of the matter is that within this tiny insurance market, you have had a series of tort reform efforts that began in the 70s and carried all the way through up till today's effort. The last one, of course, was in 97, which culminated in a $400,000 cap, except as Senator French indicated, in severe indications of damage to the patient. And indeed, prior to that, you had a $500,000 cap. Without, there was no cap on severe damage to the patients or severe disfigurement. In addition to that, under section, and I wrote it down here in my notes, and I've forgotten whether it was Senator Huggins, but you, as part of the malpractice effort, put together 955-530, which was a panel, which is on the books right now, by the way. And that panel is a medical review panel, which is designed to review medical malpractice claims prior to them being brought to court. The panel is made up of physicians, and the purpose of that panel, by its sponsor, was to avoid the frivolous lawsuits, the unnecessary lawsuits, so that it could be reviewed and analyzed quickly, efficiently, and hopefully weed those cases out of the system. That panel is routinely waived by the defense. I sitting here, I can't tell you why. The insurance defense bar does not use that panel, but they do not. Whether it's because they can't get doctors to sit on the panel, in the context of ascertaining exactly what the issues are, because as the doctor indicated, it's a small state. I mean, you've only got 600,000 people. The doctors are like any other profession, the engineers, the lawyers, everybody knows everybody else, and you're loath to sit in judgment on a friend or an acquaintance or a colleague. It's very, very difficult to do. But in any event, there is such a panel, it exists, and it's not being used as we sit here today. Now, with the tiny market comes the idea that who's the tail and who's the head?
Mr. Dillon, Senator Huggins has a question.
Sure.
Paul, would you characterize, based on your research, what the function of this panel does and what its authority is?
First, let me say I'm not an expert. I didn't review the statute coming into today's hearing. My recollection, Senator, of the statute is that its function is to review the issue of medical negligence and causation of damages and to render a report based on those two issues. And insofar as its authority is concerned, in the context of how it's used, it is designed to be a tool to weed out the wheat from the chaff, the frivolous cases that shouldn't be brought, to provide a level of protection for the medical field and to avoid those cases going into the courts.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead, Senator.
Let's say that the panel rule is thou shall not go forward. Does that stop the process, or is it just advisory?
it does not necessarily kill the process. If the panel rules that they don't find any negligence or that there's no legal causation with regard to the negligence, it is ultimately the plaintiff's call as to whether or not to file in suit.
Okay, so I guess in plain English, it's advisory. I mean, I don't know. I'm just trying to figure out whether they have any authority or not. It sounds like it's advisory.
Well, it carries great weight because of the evidentiary value and the wake-up call that it provides to all of the parties. If I'm representing, let me just back up for a minute, Senator, if I can. A medical malpractice case is probably one of the most expensive cases a plaintiff's lawyers can handle. There's a few others being class actions against insurance companies, but these are very, very expensive and very time-consuming. A malpractice lawyer, at least in our firm, we screen hundreds of cases each year, and maybe we'll take less than 10 in any given year. The cases we take are all screened based on doctors' reviews of those cases. This isn't a situation where a lawyer can press the issue home. It has to have the support of the medical profession behind it. If it doesn't, you're like a fish out of water. You're flopping on the beach. You're not going to make it home. You're not going to make it for settlement purposes, and you're not going to make it for trial. So in that context, you can see the importance of the medical advisory panels, or the panels, insofar as them rendering expert opinions regarding the particular causation issue or negligence issues in the case. It's clearly a wake-up call in the context of the plaintiff's lawyer. There's no. We're not going to take a case that we can't win.
I understand. So, in your professional judgment, from a legal standpoint, that you think that this is an intermediate step, would be a protective process for both the plaintiff and the practicing physician and the physician fraternity, as well as the legal system.
I think so. Yes, that's my personal opinion. The availability of insurance, and I think the doctor testified to this, as did the doctors last time around, Mr. Chairman, that the costs presently are acceptable. I mean, if you look at the Division of Insurance data, which I've got someplace here in terms of the update, you will see that although, you know, you can always do things with numbers anytime you want. You can always make the results come out where you need them. The Division of Insurance is indicating that the medical premiums have actually declined over the last 13 years for purposes of doctors. And as the doctor pointed out, there are certain high-risk professions that, in terms of OBGYN, that may fall outside of the norm, but the bottom line is, in terms of the premium base in Alaska, over a long period of time, according to the Division of Insurance, it's dropped. Now, with regard to availability of insurance, I am not sure what Dr. Gower was referring to insofar as the writing of insurance for new doctors in the state. Availability, backing up for a minute, what we're talking about here is a circumstance where the pool of insurance companies are called admitted insurance companies. That means that they are regulated by the state of Alaska, by the Division of Insurance, which means that they have to file documentation with the Division of Insurance to set things like premiums. Their policies are reviewed and regulated. I mean, this is not something that's being done in a void. You have an arm of government that is working through medical malpractice carriers, just like they're working through legal liability carriers, just like they're working through State Farm, Allstate, and the majors. So their premiums are reviewed by the state of Alaska. If the insurance industry was in a crisis, the Division of Insurance would know about it. I called them yesterday, and I mean, they don't know of any crisis by NorCal at this point. So the insurance industry isn't in a crisis. And again, Mr. Chairman, this is just my testimony, and I would urge this committee to verify that which I'm saying by calling in the Division of Insurance. Talk to them.
Are you familiar with the nature of the two insurance companies you're talking about? Are they stock companies? Are they mutual companies?
I believe the doctor described them correctly.
As mutual companies?
I believe so.
So if they had increased losses, they simply would pass that on to their members. Is that correct?
That would be absolutely
so
true.
A crisis might be indicated, to, as far as an economic crisis, as far as they're concerned, in increased premiums. Would that not be correct?
Absolutely.
Thank you.
It could be.
Thank you.
The only trouble is that there haven't been any, Chairman.
Well, I think the good doctor just told me his went up 12%. My physician said hers went up 11% this year. Would that indicate in a mutual company that their stock portfolio was bad or that their losses were high?
If, and again, Mr. Chairman, we can play with these numbers depending on whether you're comparing last year and this year or whether you're comparing a 3-year average or a 5-year average or a 13-year average. I'm just using the Division of Insurance statistics.
Yeah, I'm just saying that to my doctor, she says it's a crisis to her when she has to pump another 11% into her medical malpractice. So I guess we all have different definitions of the word crisis. But.
Well, I don't know if we actually do have different definitions of what the word crisis means, Mr. Chairman, in the context of if this bill is so important that we have a crisis. What I'm trying to go through is there a crisis in the insurance industry? Apparently not. From the perspective of physicians, the availability of physicians is, I would agree, the potential of a crisis. In the United States as well as in Alaska. And if you've been reading over the course, and there's many physicians here who can comment on this, if you look at the way we managed our medical schools and our admission to the medical schools in the 80s and the 10-year period that it takes to train a doctor in the context of getting them online, so to speak, they are predicting huge national shortfalls of physicians by 2020.
Absolutely, I agree with that.
Nothing to do with insurance, nothing to do with caps.
But it would have something to do with insurance. If I know that I'm high in demand, I can go anywhere I want to, and one place would cost me a whole lot more to do business than the other, or subject me to greater liability than the other, wouldn't it?
You can't suggest that because a physician doesn't want to come to Alaska because he doesn't like the weather or the isolation or you know, he wants to be working at cutting edge surgery in Houston, they're not going to come to Alaska. You're going to get doctors that come here that want to be here to enjoy the natural side of Alaska. You know, we're very unique, and we've been blessed with very good physicians. And I don't think that stream is going to dry up, and I certainly don't think that the insurance issues in this state are any different, nor are they new, than any place in the lower 48. I would be worried, and I'm worried for my children, of which I have three, that if there's going to be a huge shortfall in physicians, how do we rectify that?
We look at that in many different industries. I look at it in terms of mechanics. How am I going to find the next certified mechanic to work on my vehicles in my shop? But, you know, I think we're getting close to the end. I was just going to mention that before we get to the end of the day, because other people do, there's a session coming up here shortly. Earlier today, in looking at, you mentioned one of the comments that I made earlier, in looking at through the Alaska Action Trust information that was, I think was, the paper was prepared by Melissa Faust, the Executive Director of the Alaska Action Trust. In one statement is there, deterring malpractice is the best way to bring down costs and protect our families. Is that not a left-handed slap at the quality of doctors?
No, I don't think so. Deterring malpractice is something that as a lawyer, I'm very concerned with. Your mechanics are very concerned with. We don't want to malpractice. We don't want to make a mistake, and the doctors don't want to make a mistake. They are working as diligently as any profession is in terms of their continuing medical education. In fact, I just gave a seminar to physicians on on, in part, this exact issue.
But wouldn't that be exactly part of what they do on an everyday basis, deterring, trying to deter any malpractice? They don't want to make mistakes.
How can it be a slap if they're trying to do it?
I mean, they're always trying to, but this would indicate to me that there's more room for improvement there, at least to the point that it 11 or 12% in terms of just the improvement that should be made this year in terms of the rising cost of insurance.
Doesn't relate. I'd have to spend more time than I think the chairman's willing to give me to respond to that point. But the two don't link up. The rise in the insurance, in terms of the continuing education and effort to avoid malpractice, is something that's an internal situation with the doctors. And they are, in my opinion, working hard, just I think as many professions are, to avoid that problem.
I think, and again, I'm not going to argue with you on the issue, but the general public person taking a look at that would look at it as an inflammatory statement, at least saying, look, if doctors just did a better job, we wouldn't have these increases.
I think the general public understands that people make mistakes. I think the lesson that every lawyer who addresses physicians addresses as a number one or two issue in their lecture is communication with your patients. And the fact that mistakes do happen. But if you communicate to your patient, you are going to seriously avoid a huge percentage of potential legal problems.
Or in some cases, you can put something on the record that's discoverable in the terms of an apology that can be used against you in the future.
If you have an apology, if an apology is warranted, Mr. Chairman, I am sure that if your mechanics failed to fix somebody's car, you would apologize on behalf of your dealership and your mechanic, and you would fix that car.
Absolutely.
So what is the problem with the physicians doing the same thing?
I think the higher you go up the telephone pole, the bigger the target on your hind end. And when someone is perceived as an easy economic target, the line forms at the door and goes around the corner. And I think that's what doctors are trying to find a way to avoid. And if we can do that, if we can make sure that the truly meritorious cases are settled, and are settled in the proper manner, and get rid of the frivolous side of the things, then I think we've all done everybody a favor, including the legal profession, including those people that are physicians, including those people who may have been harmed. I think that's what the intent of the committee is to try to do, is to find where that is. If that's in the cap, or if it's in mandatory arbitration prior to action being brought, or if it's increasing the saying that you can't waive 09-55-536 in the media, you know, we are looking at ways that number one, a smaller percentage of whatever is awarded has to be paid out by the person who's awarded it for legal services or to address those cases where they truly are meritorious. And I think that's what our intent is. We do have to cut short today, and I know that we've got a lot of folks that are here, but we'll carry this bill over. We have meetings that are scheduled at 10:30, and we will bring this up again probably tomorrow. With that, I apologize to all those we didn't get to yet, but I think everyone understands that this is a very important issue for discussion in the community. Thank you, and the committee meeting is adjourned.